Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, did you hear one set of footsteps or two? Was the gunshot before the door slam or after? And how to listen, how to really listen to audio. Our guest is Tim Dolbear. He's a mixing engineer and an audio forensics expert. It's all coming up next on Torqued. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. By Nautel, keeping you connected with your community with support and webinars, online at nautel.com/webinars. And by MaxConnect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. I'm Kirk Harnack, back in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. First of all, big thanks to Telos Alliance for giving me a couple hours on that number keeps growing. I used to say an hour, then an hour and a half. Now it's a couple hours on Thursdays to do This Week in Radio Tech. So I appreciate them and the gear that we have here in the studio. We talk about things to do with broadcasting and audio, sometimes RF, sometimes towers. Last week we talked about 100 years of old radio receivers, and that was fascinating with Beth Mann. But today we're talking about an audio topic that's just, I think, absolutely fascinating, and I know very little about. So we're going to be educated and entertained at the same time with our guest will be coming up. But first, let me bring in my co-host from some undisclosed location overlooking Manhattan. It's Chris Tobin. Hey, Chris, welcome in.
Well, thank you, Kirk. Yeah, I'm just in a combiner room, FM combiner, master antenna combiner system. To be nice, I'll say it's the Shively Labs balanced combiner, FM combiner for some of the New York stations. This is a backup site for them. So, yeah, it's good stuff.
All right. Chris, you know, the folks at Nautel, I have to guess there's got to be a Nautel transmitter or two up there where you are with 14 radio stations. I certainly have a few of them. Nautel, during this time of people, you know, we haven't come out completely yet from our COVID caves. Nautel is doing this terrific thing where they are doing a webinar every week. It is called Transmission Talk Tuesday. And it's not a webinar where they're telling you the latest and greatest feature of one of their transmitters. They're actually bringing in guests and inviting you, engineers, to participate in the Q&A. So the next one is going to be Tuesday. Next week, Tuesday, it's the 16th at 12 noon Eastern time. So 11 o'clock for us in the Central Time Zone and 10 a.m. I'm sorry, 9 a.m. over on the West Coast. It's HD radio as a revenue stream. That's the topic for next Tuesday. HD radio as a revenue stream. Jeff Welton, of course, will be your host. He just does a terrific job. And Rick Greenhut from Xperi will be discussing ideas to generate revenue, whether you're leasing out your signal, programming a niche format, creating a concept that hasn't really been done before. And that's been one of the challenges about HD radio. How do we monetize this? So it's a great thing to talk about. You want to be able to pay for the equipment that makes HD radio happen. Because once you pay for it, you know, you're pretty golden. You're good to go. It's a transmitter you may already have. It's an antenna system that you already have. So adding HD to your signal can be a real boon, especially if you can monetize it. And imagine you being the engineer going in to see the GM, going into to a conference meeting with your C-suite people and saying, here's how we can monetize that HD2 or that HD3 signal. So check it out Tuesday the 12th at noon Eastern time. These are interactive roundtable discussions with input and questions from you, the participants. You should go register, though, and that's easy. Nautel.com/webinars. Nautel.com/webinars. And when you do, you'll see the link to sign up for Transmission Talk Tuesday. I got to attend a few minutes, actually most of the last one, and it was fascinating. Richard Parker was there talking about getting to transmitter sites in Alaska. Jeff Welton was there too. And actually, Charlie Wooten's been on one here recently too about disaster recovery. So Chris, have you gotten to attend any of those Nautel webinars with Jeff Welton?
I've been doing my best to attend. I've had to do some replays, but yeah, I missed this week's because of other commitments that just occurred Thursday morning. Didn't help me, but yeah, no, they've been great. I mean, anyone who has not tried them should definitely check it out. It's well worth it. It's insightful because it makes you think. You sit back and listen to somebody's experience of whatever they're doing, whatever their topic may be, and you go, oh, that's something similar to maybe what I think I did have, or I never thought of it that way. So it's good. It's really good stuff. You have to try it, and it doesn't cost much.
Actually, I got my dates confused. I would be remiss to mention that this last week it was Tom Morris and Charlie Wooten. And Tom had that all those California fires around the transmitter site. It's amazing. The one thing that didn't burn, the one thing that didn't burn was the LP gas tank. Is that crazy?
That's great. That's a good sign. It says well insulated and properly designed.
They said it was blow torching for a while that the tube off the top of it, you know, came off or broke or something, and it was sitting there blow torching. But the tank didn't blow up. How about that?
Well, it's releasing pressure, so the pressure buildup came out through the broken pipe. So that's why.
There you go.
Otherwise,
you
would have had a what do they call it, a blevy. It would have been a boiling liquid explosive vapor.
Ooh,
that's not a good thing.
No, not a good
thing.
Yeah,
it's not good stuff. No, it's not. I've seen the videos.
I think one of my children had that for a while till we got the Pepto-Bismol out.
Well, it is gas related. It's just in a different form, and the container is slightly different.
Yeah. All right, nautel.com/webinars. Be sure you go there. Okay, Chris, our guest today is someone I met about a year ago or so, and he's local to Nashville. He's in my area. It's Tim Dolbear. Tim, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you. Oh, my goodness. You're in some kind of a mixing studio. Tell us about Tim Dolbear. What do you do?
Well, I'm a full-time audio engineer, and what you're seeing around me, behind me, is Eclectica Studios here in Nashville, Tennessee, which is my own personal workspace. It's a two-room facility, actually three, if you count the bathroom, which gets a guitar amp in there every once in a while. And I've been working in full-time audio engineering since last century, and just over a year ago, I moved to Nashville. This is where I'm at all the time. I kind of wish that I built some windows in it so I could see a little sunlight a little bit more often. But yeah, this is where I'm at 12 hours a day.
Take some vitamin D and spend some time on the patio if you have to.
I got my studio tan happening.
So give us a little tease about what we're going to be talking about online, social media. I had mentioned about forensic audio analysis. Was there one person or two in that room, or did the door slam first, or was that the gunshot we heard first? So a little tease about the utility or the excitement or the draw of forensic audio analysis.
It's not something I set out to do. There's so many different areas of audio forensic, and the one area that I specialize in is audio recovery, which in layman's term is cleaning up stuff so you can hear people, or cleaning up audio so you can hear if there's two people in the room or just one. And I have friends that work in various different areas, including Mark Rubel here in Nashville, who works doing a lot of copyright infringement cases where someone has lifted a sample from a song and put it on another song, and it's been time stretched, maybe pitch changed. And his job is to go through and see if it actually is that Huey Lewis song that it was lifted from and is now on this, but sounds slightly different, you know? And so he's hired to go through and see if he can recreate the steps they did to make it, and if it does match. And then there's other people that I've known who work in the, like you're talking, how many gunshots, what was the direction the gunshots came from, various things like that. And so that's a whole other specialty, which can be really fun, because then you're out in a field shooting a gun with microphones in various spots, trying to recreate exactly what you're hearing. As well as when you do it, you have to eliminate all the echoes off of buildings. You know, if it was a shooting downtown, you have all of the echoes coming in at the same time that you have to weed through. Was that a shot? Was it an echo? And what the placement is. And that gets really in depth. There's a lot more math in that. That's why I stay away from it. Really, I just do cleanup.
There's another topic we're going to cover too in the show, and that has to do with how to listen. And I've never done mixing or you've also done mastering. I've never done either of those. Don't know much about it. I have done audio processing. And so we'll get into some examples of how to listen, because it turns out that's pretty important to make everything sound as good as it can be. So hang on, Tim Dolbear, Chris Tobin and me all talking about audio forensics. Well, mostly Tim, and how to listen. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by my friends at this place, Max Connect Wireless. If I hold that so it doesn't glare, you can see it better. Max, see how it's spelled funny? Because, you know, that's what you have to do to get things on the internet. MaxConnectWireless.com. And what's different about this? I was just talking to some people last week about Max Connect Wireless and how they're using it at their transmitter site as a backup studio transmitter link. So you get a fixed IP address no matter which carrier you pick. By the way, yeah, this is a cradle point modem. There are other 4G LTE modems that work as well. And this one, though, what's key here is not so much the modem. Cradle point's fine. There's others that Max Connect has too. But what's inside? Inside here are two SIM cards, but they're for the AT&T network or the Verizon network. T-Mobile's also available. But Max Connect Wireless is actually a carrier. And with Max Connect Wireless, you get prioritized 4G LTE data. That means your packets go before everybody else's, except for first responders. So you can be in a stadium full of people. Okay, right now during COVID, you wouldn't be. But hopefully this fall, you will be. You'll be covering sporting events, parades, city council meetings where there's lots of people with their cell phones, you know, checking their Facebook or live tweeting the meeting, whatever it may be. And you, as a Max Connect Wireless customer, you get priority with your data. And that means it really does work. We tried this actually at the SBE national meeting in Las Vegas back a little over a year ago. And we tried just using my cell phone and my T-Mobile hotspot on there. And I had, you know, great speed indicated. But man, it was dropping a lot of packets and our video was not looking good. So we did that as an experiment beforehand. We also had a Max Connect wireless box and we hooked up to that. And even though the speed wasn't as high, it was plenty high for the video. No packets dropped, at least none that we could see or notice. We had a clear picture the whole time using Max Connect Wireless. So let me encourage you to check it out for your transmitter site, for your remote kit, for your Go kit, MaxConnectWireless.com. There's a link in our show notes today, and check that out for your remote broadcasts and your emergency links, like to your transmitter sites. It's just a great thing to have. And Josh Bone is signing up people left and right. There are some major U.S. broadcasters that are using this. All right, it's Kirk Harnack, Chris Tobin, and our guest Tim Dolbear here. And Chris, I'm excited to learn about this. And Tim, I'm not sure what topic you want to cover next. I think the you mentioned that you've got to clean the audio up before you can kind of do forensic analysis on it. You got to hear what people are saying. You got to hear what people are doing. So maybe we talk first about audio cleanup and some of the techniques that you use for that. You know, what do you hear from the raw audio recording, and what do you, you know, how do you determine what has to be cleaned up from the junk that you're hearing? Why don't you tell us about that world?
Sure, and it's different now too with a digital world. In the olden days when we used to have analog tape and stuff, you would have voices in it and it might be down in the noise floor, but you'd still be able to hear it. The resolution was there. You'd be able to hear stuff quietly and you could enhance it and bring it out. Now in the world of digital, I'll get recordings in that were done on phones that are 4-bit WAV files. So the bandwidth ends at 2K and the resolution of it is worse than the worst crushed MP3 you've ever heard. And once the audio is gone in a situation like that, it's just gone. There's just nothing to recover at that point. If you have a low resolution file where it's removed a lot of the voice and the voice is choppy, kind of like if you take a picture and you make it really pixelated, you can't see what the numbers are on a license plate. Well, really pixelated audio of a voice is kind of the same thing, where you're not hearing the pronunciation, you're not hearing the words, you're hearing more of a kind of jumble. And so that gets where you run into a lot of issues there. And I know after, you know, so many years of doing this, as soon as I listen to something, is it recoverable? And one of the first things I look at is just the file type. If the file is just an M4A phone file, and it's so, you know, this is a 4-hour recording and the file is only 2 megs in size. Yeah. there's just no audio left to recover from. And that really dictates.
I want to go back and ask you about something, because you mentioned that in the early days of this, when you were dealing with like analog tape, in many ways that could even be better. Sure, you had the tape noise, but you had every bit of detail that the tape. Now, sure, it may have been a cassette recording and you'd get a lower quality there, but that must be terribly frustrating. And I don't know how people, I don't know how you make such a bad quality from a phone. I mean, usually these things default now to pretty decent quality. But I do know what you're saying. I mean, I've got older cell phones where I took movies that were just, how bad can this possibly be? Although modern phones from these days, you know, they default to, you know, pretty good quality video and audio.
It's remarkably, it's remarkable how people are able to make such bad recordings when the default, you just hit default, but they're like, oh, I'm going to record the next 6 hours of this room. So what setting, remember on an old VCR, you would have your 2 hour, 4 hour, 6 hour, you know,
and
you
go back and watch and SLP, but you record something on SLP and it was horrible.
It looked horrible. Yeah. Well, the same thing happens with where, 6 hours, I can get 6 hours of recording time on this and it's a small file and hey, that's convenient. But then they send it to me and I can't do anything. And I've had files come in where the background noise is just nothing. It's beautifully digitally recorded. The hiss is low. You can hear the voices loudly, but the resolution's so bad that you can't understand everything they're saying by any means.
Okay. You know, okay. So that's one of the downsides.
If you're trying to capture whispering, and it only goes up to 2K in frequency, well, half of what is coming out is 8,000, 10,000 hertz as far as getting the definition of the word. So,
So it occurs to me that, you know, modern day electronics record using bit rate reduction techniques, and we generally call that perceptual audio codecs, right? And the perceptual audio codec is designed around having a decent audio level coming into it, so that it can discern what's noise, what's duplicative, and what is really important to be represented in the bits. But if you've got, if the phone is under a bed, behind a closet, on the back of a bookshelf, and the audio level coming into it is 30, 40, 50 dB lower than the codec was designed for, and the codec is set to a low bit rate resolution, then that's going to be a real problem. So what do you do to try to remedy that if what you're starting with is terribly pixelated, so to speak?
It's interesting. So if I get a file in, the main thing I always think about when I listen for it is, can I hit play for anybody and they listen to it and understand exactly what's going on? I of course can't tell them beforehand, can't lead the witness, but if I play it for you, can you discern and hear clearly what's being said? Because if I can't just hit play and have it play out of my computer speaker and have you hear it and go, oh yeah, the person said blah, 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 then we're done. We're done. It has to be where I can play. If I get called to do a remote deposition, you know, I have to be able to hit play and have it play. And then I can explain what I think I'm hearing. But if they can't hear it clear, it might as well be nothing. It might as well be nothing. And in court, if you ever play in front of a jury, if they can't hear it, it might as well be nothing.
So that you bring up a good point about you can't tell them what it says, because that would put an idea in their mind. But so often sometimes we see on the news, or more likely now on YouTube, we'll see an explanation of like an aircraft accident. Now, I've been a pilot, and so I have an idea of what air traffic control is going to say to me and what I'm going to say back to them. I have an expectation of the verbiage that will be spoken. And so even if it's not really all that clear, we know what we're saying. Actually, we're more alerted. Our brains are alerted when something is said that isn't what we were expecting. That's when our brains are alerted that, hey, you got to listen or ask for clarification. So often on newscasts, we'll see a transcript of what ATC said and what the pilot said. And for the layperson, without that transcript, you have no idea what they said. So that's a benefit that you get when you're not in a courtroom. Man, I'm just thinking, how do you arrange, how do you do this to where you're not, because I guess you can't give them a transcript of what was said, because that could be suggestive of something that wasn't said.
It depends on what it is. If it's a private citizen, I can give a transcript, and I will, of what I believe is being said here, and I'm willing to testify, stake my reputation, that the person said this. I will, you know, I will put in parentheses, it's like, I think they said this, but I won't testify to it. I think it's this. I'll have citizens contact me for cleanup work, which is a fair amount of my work at this point. It used to be law enforcement. I would have law enforcement bring me files, bring me tapes, bring me things, and have me clean it up. And now almost all my work comes in from private citizens and some companies, corporation type stuff. But mostly it's private citizens, which is why so much is being recorded with phones. Because if it's a man sending me a recording, it's him recording his wife because he's sure she's cheating on him. And here's a secret. Only 1 out of 50 actually is. If it's a female, it's most likely she's recording workplace harassment. And so she has her phone on her desk upside down. It's recording when someone comes into the room and stuff, and she needs it cleaned up and everything. And I have 1,000 funny stories. For the first scenario, there are no funny stories for the workplace harassment, because I haven't had a single one come through that wasn't actually workplace harassment going on.
Wow.
As opposed to the adulterous wife, like I said, it's 1 out of 50. And it's 1 out of 50. And when that shows up, the minute I hit play, I know instantly that it is. Because half of this job is psychology, understanding what makes sense and what's logical. Kind of like what you're saying when you listen to the air traffic controller and a pilot talk, you're a pilot, you understand what's going on in the back and forth. Well, I get that as far as listening to recordings. If I listen to a woman and she's talking on her phone and she's being recorded with a hidden app on her phone from her husband, and that's what I'm cleaning up or that's what I'm analyzing or whatever it is, usually they're pretty clean. So that kind of stuff is mostly they want just an expert to listen to it and verify what they're hearing. And sometimes try to enhance the person on the other side, because it doesn't record directly. It has to record through the earpiece back to the microphone and in.
Oh.
And so sometimes that second person is hard to hear, but it's not needed in certain cases. You'll hear the person make a phone call. And for instance, one, obviously I'm not going to use names or exact details. One lady got in her car, started driving, picked up her phone, called her daughter, and was chatting like this, like I am right now, hangs up the phone. And then to make our job real easy says, you know, Siri, call Bill or whatever it was. I mean, she even says the name and calls. And the minute he answers, her entire demeanor shifts to, hi, oh, I, it was so fun today. I look forward to next week. Can we meet in the same place? I mean, everything about the way she was talking completely changed. That if they had not had sex, they of course would be very soon. It was completely different. Then after that phone call, she made another phone call and she was right back to the original demeanor, which is completely different.
Wow. So
you can, anyone can listen to that and go that there's, it's blatant that something is going on here.
So people listening to the show are familiar with a lot of the standard multi-track digital audio workstation software that we would use at radio stations. Yeah. Maybe not as sophisticated as what you put to use there. Maybe you do use these off-the-shelf tools, though. Can you, without giving away all your company secrets, can you tell us what some of the things are that we do to audio? And, you know, use a downward expansion or, you know, EQ or whatever you want to use. How do you clean this stuff up?
So the main problem is I'll have clients that, oh, I tried fixing this or cleaning it with Audacity and it sounds terrible. Mm-hmm. And I of course say, can you send me the real file? Well, the real file is 6 hours. I don't care. Send me the 6 hour file. I need the original of this. Not to mention, I want to make sure I'm working on the original and not something doctored. Because I'll have people, oh, this is the original. And I look at it on, RX7 Advance, which is one of my main tools from Isotope that I use for this. Mm. The minute I open it up and I look at the waveform, I can tell if someone already dinkered with it. And meanwhile, they're telling me, oh no, I've never touched it. It's like, I can, this is all I do is stare at this stuff. And I could tell when something's been messed with, by sight and by sound. And, yeah. And the main thing is people try to take, if you record a vocal for a song and there's air conditioning noise in the background, you go and you're trying to clean out all of the noise all the way down the best you can and trying to make the voice sound perfect and hi-fi and awesome. Audio forensics recovery is the complete opposite of that. I don't care if the voice has the perfect amount of 8K sparkle, a little bit of air on top and a great 120 at the bottom. That, none of that matters. It does not matter if it sounds good. It has to sound clear. And so sometimes I'm providing files that have all of the noise still in the file. And all that I've done is use filtering to enhance the voice to bring it out of the noise. Because if I had used noise reduction or noise print on it to pull the noise off of it, I might lose too much of the voice.
Yeah. Yeah. And that brings up a question. I think our ears and our brains work together as a terrific filtering system in many, many scenarios. And so when do you decide, okay, if I filter this more or do some noise extraction by sampling noise and extracting that, if I do that, it's now less intelligible than if I let the person hear most of it, maybe a little EQ, get rid of some annoying things, and let their brains filter out the speech. Because a computer program doesn't really, well, it may identify speech, but it doesn't know what was said. But your ears, at least if you're for the same language, listening to English, even though the audio is poor, your brain kind of fills that in and understands it. How do you decide that balance?
Well, two ways. One, I listen. Two, I provide multiple versions of it, because one sentence might sound better on a version where I did noise reduction, and the next one might sound better where I do a reverse FFT filter enhancement, which is just a FFT EQ, which is a high steep EQ, and you reverse it. You flip it inside out, you could say. There's no easy way of saying it. And that enhances the voice. You're trying to, you make the voice disappear using the FFT filter, and then you reverse the result. So that way you're hearing the voice. So I put multiple versions. So that way, you know, if one sentence sounds or one section sounds better, one thing, next section, we can jump from version to version to see what's being enhanced. If we can't hear one word on one, we can listen to a different file that was done with a different way. And it's, hopefully enhanced in that one. But you're mentioning brain, which is a really, really interesting thing about this. Our phones can pick up whispering really well and really easy. Almost better than someone talking softly in a room. In fact, probably better than someone talking softly in a room. It picks up whispers because the microphone's so tiny. It just picks them up. Phones do great for whispering. And I'll get people who will send me files and they're like, oh yeah, right here. There's so-and-so's. I know they're there. And there's people whispering about me or talking about this transaction or whatever it is. And your brain might actually be making all of that up through a thing called audio pareidolia. Audio pareidolia is, I believe that's how you pronounce it. I'm always questioning myself when I get to audio pareidolia. But what it is if you hear static or white noise or any type of just hiss, your brain is hearing random sounds and is desperately trying to chain together sounds to become something recognizable that it can report on. And so when you listen to static, just straight static, you might want to try this sometime. Put on some pink noise or white noise and just listen to it. You swear you'll start hearing people speaking in it, whispers and stuff. That's called audio pareidolia. And that's because your brain's trying to recognize anything desperately to chain it together and make it useful and work. And so one of the main things I have to do is go through and clean up files that have a lot of hiss, a lot of noise, where they swear someone is talking or whispering or said something. And I'm looking at it on the screen, and for one, I'm not seeing the harmonic structure of the voice, of voices in it. And two, when I'm cleaning it out, there's nothing there. And because you can't come back to a client and say, well, nah, it's on your head. Good luck. There's nothing there. You have to actually kind of prove it. And one of the first things I do when I'm listening through a file is I'm mapping out the room. So in a recording of a room, if someone is in that room, I start listening to all the different things that I hear happening. If there's a clock ticking, if there's footsteps in the room, if was there a door that opened and closed? Do I hear cars outside? Do they sound like this because it's through a wall? You start mapping out and you get really good at that over time. If someone sets a pencil down, as an example, on a table, You know how loud that is. And by the amount of reverb in the room of that pencil, you can tell how close to the microphone it was and how loud it was. And then all of a sudden, if someone talks lightly in the room, you can also tell where they're at. And so if it's a small little office room or a small bedroom and you hear a pencil or you hear someone open up a drawer and close it really softly, and they're saying, well, there's someone in there talking. It's like, well, then why can I hear this so clearly and loudly and I'm not hearing that? Or why am I hearing rustling of clothes, but I can't hear talking, which is, 12 times louder? You really have to map out that room. And all of the different things that happen in the room are important. So when someone says we're listening for a voice, we want to try to prove that that someone's in there talking, they have a conversation about me. It's so important that we listen to all the elements because they're just as important at that point as a person talking, because of location. I just had one that was a guy in a room. Wife thought for sure, this is actually the opposite. Wife thought for sure that there is a female in the room and he's talking to her. And so I start cleaning up the room and the noise. There's air conditioning in the background. There's music playing in the background too in the next room and stuff. But I can very distinctly hear on a keyboard of his laptop or whatever, he's typing. And then he's talking. He's just talking to himself as he types. He's the only one in the room. And I'm not hearing extra sets of footsteps. I'm not hearing extra sets of clothes. I'm hearing something that very logically to me, I can visualize the scene. He is typing out an email or something and he's mumbling to himself like we all do, or kind of, talking out loud a little bit to himself. And that's it. There's nothing else going on.
Wow.
I'm throwing a lot at you all at once, I know.
Well, you could go back and report to the wife, well, he is having an affair. It is with himself.
With himself.
He's talking with himself. Yeah.
One of the ones I always remember because it was so interesting, and I'm going to try to keep this as PG-13 as possible, but I had someone send me a recording. A wife was sneaking guys into the bedroom during the day and having sex with them. And he set up a recorder in his bedroom, and he thankfully put it on the floor underneath the dresser or at the edge of the dresser. And so it would catch the hallway, the front room, bathroom, all these different rooms. It picked it up in a really nice place. And then he told her that he's going out of town on business for a week. And he left it recording for the weekend. And because then she'd know, hey, he can't just walk back in. My boyfriend can come over, no problem. And he left and went out of state and came back 3 or 4 days later and sent it to me and was really upset. There is a sex scene happening in the middle of this tape. And very blatantly, can confirm it fully, but it was, shall we say, a solo flight. and I had to prove it to the guy because, he got the proof that he wanted. He heard her having sex and he's ready to divorce her over this. He went out of town and was ready to divorce her. Well, I was able to show him in the sub frequencies of the recordings down around 30 hertz and 40 hertz footsteps. Because it's the house obviously has a crawl space or is a mobile home where the footsteps were very boomy. Yeah, and yeah. Every footstep throughout this recording had the same weight, like cadence, the same boom, very specific, no matter how far off in the room or different rooms it walked to, it always had the same kind of tone and the same tempo of walk. And there was only ever one set of footsteps at a time. And if someone's sneaking someone into your house for anything, they're not going to do one set of footsteps at a time all day long when the spouse is out of town. The other thing is if someone, I'll have the same thing. The person sneaks someone in and, oh, yeah, you can hear them whispering. It's like if someone sneaks someone in and you're not home, no one's whispering. No one's whispering. Even if one of the spouse and one of the two people involved says, "You stay quiet, just in case they're recording. I want to, you know." Well, one, they're not going to sneak a person into that if they know that there's some type of recording going on. And two, if a third party is snuck in, especially if in that type of a situation, that third party is almost always going to not whisper at some point because they want to leave their mark. Because they kind of do want to get caught. That seems to happen often. The other thing is you can't get two people to whisper for an hour straight.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen.
Yeah.
I had one lady send me a recording. She said people were in her living room for 12 hours. There were six of them and they were all whispering back and forth about how they were going to get her. And it went on for 12 hours straight. She recorded the whole thing over phone. And sent it to me to enhance the voices. The six people whispering for 12 hours straight in her living room. And in the recording, I can hear her dog, you know, little tiny dog running across the room. I can hear stuff outside, cars driving by, things, you know, the most faint sound ever. I heard no whispering. But also, when I told her there's no whispering on this, she would not take that as an answer that it's audio pareidolia just going crazy on her. But I had to explain to her, it's like six people in a room whispering for 12 hours. Well, one, if they're plotting to get you, won't they be done in 5 minutes? And two, you're not going to keep six people whispering. Someone's going to, I'll slip up. There's no way I'm going to be able to pull off whispering over a 12-hour period.
Yeah.
And no footsteps and no movement. They must have just been sitting still, you know. So there's a lot of, hey, this doesn't make sense. If it doesn't make sense, it's not true.
You've mentioned this several times. We'll put a link in the show notes to audio pareidolia. That is a whole big topic. It's brilliant. And there's visual pareidolia that's a thing too. We're talking to Tim Dolbear. Tim Dolbear runs a mixing recording studio. He's a former talk show host. He's a writer and a speaker on topics of audio. And he also does mixing, mastering, and audio forensics and cleanup. So we're talking to Tim today, and thanks for joining us here on This Week in Radio Tech to hear what he has to say. Chris Tobin is here too. And Chris, we're talking for just a couple of minutes about the Broadcasters General Store and something that that we need in the broadcast business, and that's the Henry Superlight. Chris, I bet you've installed some Henry Super relays here and there. I certainly have. That would take a contact closure from an audio console, from a switch, and turn that into an 110-volt output to light a light on the studio, an on-air light, but would also give you a whole bunch of relay outputs. Well, there's a modern version of that now because there's so many on-air lights nowadays that don't run on 110, 120 volts anymore. They're LED lights. Now, they're green, they're energy conscious, and they're easy to control when you have this super light from Henry Engineering. Now, it's a remote control interface for controlling LEDs and other low voltage studio tally lights, ideal for switching your on-air warning lights when a studio mic is live. It can be controlled with almost any broadcast console or network studio and can directly power any 12-volt tally light that requires half an amp or less. A flasher circuit's included to flash the light when it's on, and there are also two Form C relay contacts that can give you speaker muting. Let's say that you're using a little Behringer or a Mackie console, something that doesn't mute the speakers for you like a broadcast console does. Well, you can use this to mute those speakers for you. It can be controlled with DC or a GPI contact closure. It's the control is via these Euro blocks, but there are also two RJ45 connectors on it here that are provided for compatibility with network installations that can use Cat5, Cat6 cabling. Any two wires of the RJ45 can be user assigned to control the Superlight with a DC input. And it can be looped through also to other units, and those other units can either use the same a pair, or they can use other pairs. You can have a really sophisticated system with just some jumper settings and some Cat6 cable. So wiring can be really, really convenient. The Henry Superlight LED Tally Light controller. And of course, the other half is, where do you get them? Well, here's the sheet on it that you can read all about what it does, its input and output specs, and if it'll do exactly what you want it to. And I think chances are that it will do exactly what you want it to. You can check it out from Broadcasters General Store. They have them, and they can get them to you quickly. Broadcasters General Store is bgs.cc on the web, bgs.cc, just five letters and a dot. Or you can call them, and you got the number memorized? I do. It's 352-622-7700. You can talk to Dave Kirsten there. You can talk to Jonathan Shute, Jessica. You can talk to Carrie Kirsten, any of them there. There's a whole slew of people who are very knowledgeable about broadcast equipment. And as importantly as that, BGS can tell you very accurately how long it'll take to get this. They'll give you the best price, and they can give you shipping information and track that thing for you too. So if they keep good track of the products that they're sending out to you. Broadcasters General Store at bgs.cc. Thanks so much to BGS and to Henry Engineering, Hank Landsberg, for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. Hey, it's Kirk Harnack here along with Chris Tobin. Chris, we've been talking about audio forensics, and as much as we could probably talk about that for the whole hour, I think we're going to have to move into how to listen. And I want to set Tim up a little bit. First of all, Chris, do you have any incident, any time in your broadcast career when the light kind of went on in your head, hey, I need to learn how to listen, or, oh, this is how you listen to audio to determine quality and characteristics? You had any stories about that for us, Chris?
Actually, yeah, I did. Early on, man, just starting out, I was learning that working with friends of mine who are musicians, and we were doing recordings when, you know, tapes were popular, and recording machines like the TX, the four-track machines, two tracks, the even cassettes, Maxell UDXL2s were the popular high bias tapes that were used for recording. And I got a chance to learn with musicians for the first time in my life as a child. And it was fascinating to listen to a friend of mine who was a drummer, and he'd be setting up the kit and doing all different things and trying different ways to mute or not mute, but, you know, dampen the cymbals or the kick drum or the snare and the ride. And it's like, wow, I'm listening to this record as we're trying to record, and we play it back. And he's like, no, something wrong. I said, what do you mean? It doesn't sound right. Listen. And I'm listening. I'm like, I think I hear what was recorded. And it was just fascinating. That was the early days. Then fast forward to more years later, and I started working at a couple of facilities like the ABC Radio Networks. And there I got exposed to, oh, we're going to do satellite-delivered audio in a digital format, which means it's going to be possibly compressed. And we're going to learn how algorithms work and what they do. And it was fascinating because I discovered through that some of the stuff I had already done earlier in my, you know, like teens doing recordings matched. Now it's the digital equivalent of, here's what happens when you go from the analog sine wave, as I make the motion with my finger, to the zeros and ones, the sampling parts of that sine wave and trying to recreate them. It was fascinating. I mean, the biggest thing I always used to do early days of MP2 audio was if you really have a good quality MP2 encoder, let's record some castanets. See what they sound like when you're playing back. Oh, boy, yeah. We did some interesting playbacks, and people are like, oh, wow, that's not going to work. Yeah, you know, the CDAT and DATS channels of the old ABC satellite and CBS and NBC networks, so the audio. We did a lot of evaluation of algorithms, and it's fascinating the things you learn. And fast forward to today now with AAC and MP4A and all the other stuff that you have. You got to really understand what you're listening to. And I record musicians still to this day at the jazz station. We do recordings of live bands and great stuff. And the recording engineer I work with is genius in his editing and setting up the mics and listening to all those nuances. And I can tell you that we have had some fun breaking the rules with microphones that the traditional recordist will say, no, no, hi-hats have to be this type of microphone. I'm like, yeah, yeah, we know, we've read the book, but it doesn't sound right. We went with this microphone. Now what do you think? So, yes, understanding the audio, the differences in sound from, say, you know, hitting a cymbal. Now, you know, what is the phrase people use, the trash can sound or a real cymbal, where there's decay? You know,
yeah.
There's an attack and decay and all these wonderful things, like the old days of the LA-3 Urey limiters. You know, that was the popular production studio limiter. Why? It was a soft knee. Why? It used a light bulb to do compression, which means it wasn't a hard turn on or turn off. It was a slope, just like your ear. I got a chance to work with a guy at CBS Labs in Stamford, Connecticut, early on in my career, Emil Turek. I got to learn some stuff and see some things that, boy, I wish they were available in a museum today. Fascinating audio approach, him and a few other the engineers and what they did. And I read the patents he did, and I read some of his papers, and I'm like, wow, now I know how he got there. And that's what I use when I'm doing audio and I'm listening, and people look at me like, why are your eyes closed? I'm like, I'm listening. I don't want to be distracted by the visual. And I've had a few musicians actually say to me, I noticed you were listening very carefully. I appreciate that. Did you like what you heard? I'm like, yeah. So there's something to be said for that. And I'm assuming Tim does a lot of this stuff already and then adds to it with the forensic side of getting deep into it.
Well, actually, Chris, you've prompted my first question to Tim, and that is, do we hear better with our eyes closed? Tim?
We certainly mix better in this day and age, because if you're looking at the screen and you're looking at all the fancy, you know, graphic user interfaces, of course you're going to start doing stuff because it looks one way or the other. I caught myself doing that. Everyone I know who does this professionally has caught themselves at one time or another. And now when I mix, I only use EQs that have no graphic readout on the screen. It's simply just knobs. So I'm not looking at shelves being boosted in one area. And then I started thinking to myself, oh, that's too much. I can't do that much. No, no, no. It doesn't matter what it looks like. It's how it sounds. That's the important part.
Wow. So, Tim, I'd like to understand what you advise people about how to listen. And do I understand correctly that you teach some classes on this here in the Nashville area? You have, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a guest speaker at various different colleges and recording schools. Blackbird Academy is one of them, SAE Institute, Expressions College, Webster, NYU, Miami University. I've spoken on all these different ones. And I wrote an article about 4 years ago, which was the cover story for that one. Yeah, I think it was the feature article for Professional Sound Magazine. And it was about listening. And it all stemmed from an interesting visit that I had when I was in New York City. I was teaching at NYU, and I left and I went over to a world famous audio engineer or mastering engineer studio. And who I'm friends with, and we're checking things out, and he's playing me some stuff, and he wanted me to compare a D to A converter that he had there. He had the same one as mine, but he also had this other one in for loan. So he had a way of A being something back and forth. I said, great, put on something like some jazz that you've been working on, something with a lot of depth for me to listen to so I can see if I can even hear a difference to this. So he put on a song, and 30 seconds into the song, there was a click in the audio, not super loud, but it was there. And I instantly heard it, and I stopped him. I'm like, is this something that you are working on right now? And he said, yeah. He goes, I just sent it to the client. I go, there's a digital click right there. And he goes, where? And he rewound it back. He listened 3 or 4 times before he finally picked up on it and heard it. And I said to myself, self, I'm just this mixing engineer guy. And this guy is a mastering engineer whose entire back wall is wallpapered with Grammys. And he didn't hear this. Why did he not hear it? So when I got home, because he's awesome. I don't know why it wasn't his thing to listen to. So when I got home, I called up Joe Palmisio, who's an amazing mastering engineer here in Nashville, friend of mine. And we talked, and I started picking his brain about how he listens. And it dawned on me that our entire way of listening in audio production and audio engineering is two different ways. The first way is the mix engineer way, And the second way is the mastering engineer way. If you take a painting such as water lilies, the world famous painting water lilies, that is a giant Monet painting in New York City, 20, 30 feet long, I think it is. Actually, I think it's multiple parts. And if you walk up to that painting, you can see every brush stroke clear as day from a foot away, just everything. But you look at it and say, okay, this looks like nothing. There is no painting here. There's nothing. You don't see anything, but you see every detail of every stroke. And you step back 20 feet and you can't see any of the details or any of the strokes, but you can see the painting. And that's the mastering engineer. Mixing engineer is focused in on listening into the sound, listening to, okay, do the cymbals sound like trash can lids? Do the, you know, all these little tiny details in it, clicks and pops and artifacts and stuff. But a mastering engineer is standing back across the room just saying, okay, do we have the right lighting on it to show off this painting in a manner that sounds good? Which is very similar to guys that set up broadcasts for radio. Have always gone through and done a little bit of basically what mastering engineers do, a little bit of tweak to the high end and bottom and enhance stuff to make it so it sounds the best through their station. And it's really an interesting thing when you think about how we listen and how our focuses are. And being able to jump from one to another is something you have to learn. There's times where I have to listen into the sound. There's other times where I have to be back and take in the whole entire picture and turn off that detail listening and listen to it as a whole. And those are the differences between mixing and mastering.
Wow. That sounds very clear and understandable. So when I'm, when I'm adjusting an audio processor, actually I'm switching between both things at the same time. And right. I'll go ahead and tell this brief story, sure, that we were talking about before the show started. And that is, I was kind of young working for the Telos Alliance, and I was, showing Omni audio processing to a lot of different radio stations. And I was in Chicago at a big station. We were in the John Hancock building in the transmitter room, kind of a noisy room, but we also had some pretty loud speakers to overcome the transmitter blower noise. And I was there. My boss, Frank Foti, the developer of this Omnia processor, was there. And a sales rep was there for our dealer, and also the engineer for the station was there. And so we were switching, A-B-ing between these competing audio processors, one of which was an Omnia processor. And we also had a modulation monitor, because the ultimate modulation level is absolutely critical. So it was a fair fight. You know, we were both peaking right at 100%. Because if one's, you know, half a dB louder than the other, I don't know, half a dB shouldn't be discernible by the human ear, but when all the audio is packed together, it is. And so anyway, we're switching back and forth between them. And I'm standing there thinking, I can't hear the difference between these two, because they were both equally loud. The sound field was just kind of equally there, and I thought they sounded equally good. And so did the station engineer, and so did the sales rep. And I made the mistake of saying to Frank Foti, I said, Frank, they both sound really good to me. I'm having a hard time hearing the difference. Well, steam just about started coming out of his ears. What? You can't hear? What? So he says, Kirk, listen to the top end of the brass, and listen especially to the cymbals. Cymbals are really hard to get right. And listen to the difference. He didn't tell me what to listen for, but listen to the difference. So I switched between and just listened for the cymbals going on. I thought, oh, there is a difference. On the Omnia, it sounds more like cymbals. And on the other processor, it didn't. It sounded like a representation of cymbals, but it didn't sound quite musical, let's say. And so then I listened for the brass, and then I listened for other details like the higher notes that that the female artist was singing, and some snare drums that were in there. And sure enough, I thought, wow, there is a difference. Now, if mentally went back and listened to the whole sound field, and then I started to hear small differences in the whole sound field, and then I started to pick it apart, and it was okay. Now, as you said earlier, I couldn't unhear what my brain had heard. So, we end up doing both of these things as broadcast engineers. In the world now, we have smart speakers. Gee, I've got a couple of them in here. I should probably mute for the show, so in case I accidentally say their names. we want to hear, we just want something entertainment value that's the same volume all the time, but still has some bounciness to it. So to me, that's more like mastering. We want what's coming out of the consumer device to be ultimately listenable and not irritating. And to convey, you know, on a speaker this big, there's only so much detail that is discernible. So after saying all that, what could you add to what I said or dovetail into more about how to listen to audio in these different stages?
Listening is a muscle. Hmm. It's something learned. It's something developed and can get stronger over time. And it takes practice, and you got to be purposeful about it, about listening. And like we just said, you can't unhear good quality audio. Once you hear it and get used to what good quality sounds like, you can't go back from it, because you'll always pick up on the other, because you've just learned a new muscle. You know, you've flexed your muscle in a specific way and were able to lift something, and now you're always going to be able to lift that. And if that's even a good example, but it's just as your ear develops and your ear training happens, it's just always there. It'll get to a point. I mean, after 20 years of working in the studio full time, it's to the point now where my ears, sometimes it's just too much. I go to the food store and I'm walking down the aisle, and the things that I'm hearing, I just wish I could filter out. I'm just detailing in on stuff too closely, constantly. You can't turn it off because you get used to focusing in on sounds. And so it's just one of those things, is practice over time. If you do this full time, it might take you too far. That's a good way.
Some people say that after adjusting audio processing for a while, their ears get tired. And I don't mean just an hour here, an hour there, but I mean, they'll actually go and schedule themselves to go listen to a classical music concert, outdoors, or they'll go listen to some very natural sounds to kind of recalibrate their hearing. Is that a thing?
Absolutely. And I don't necessarily take it to that type of level. I do a quicker thing. In my article, which you can find on my website, I'm probably find it just by doing a search on Tim Dolbear listening article. But my website would be the easiest, timdolbear.com, in the resource area. I go into that. I asked each person I interviewed, and you won't believe the people I got on this article to interview. It's just like the best of the best audio engineers and producers, and while I had them, I asked them, how do you refresh your ears when you've been working for an hour or two? How do you reset? And there's a lot of different answers. A couple people did basically the same thing I do: stop, go outside, walk around, things like that. But if I need a real fresh refreshing of my ears really quickly, say I was EQing an acoustic guitar solo, you know, for a while, and you start losing perspective, because after a while it can sound good, even though it might be bad, because your ears have adjusted to it. And so I'll hit stop and I'll actually say something out loud to hear my voice in the room, in my head, everywhere, something I'm used to. All of a sudden I have a flat line again of what my ears are reset. Here's flat. Here's what everything normally sounds like. Hit play, and now I can hear it and I'm refreshed to it. So simple as making a sound in the room that's real and live will reset your ears to what's coming out of speakers, if that makes sense.
That's a great idea. We all know the sound of our own voice. That's a terrific idea. As a broadcast engineer, and Chris Tobin, this is often a topic of discussion on broadcast forums. What music or what songs do you use to adjust processing? And to my view, you need to use, at least for broadcast processing, you typically would want to use songs that you're intimately familiar with, that you know every nuance of the song played without processing. And for me, that might be some Steely Dan music, because it's usually very, very clean anyway in the recording.
Great recording.
True. Chris, do you have an opinion about that, to either refresh or calibrate or get your ears ready, or music, audio to use when you are adjusting something?
Well, there have been times when I've helped friends with audio processing, and we've gone a little crazy with the time and the time spent doing it. And I, from time to time, have tried the white noise, pink noise, and headphones for about 5 minutes to help clear my brain. It actually helped. And then other times, just go outside, listen to other sounds completely. It doesn't have to be music. To sort of reset, if you will, the hearing part of the brain. The one thing I will say is when it comes to processing and determining what's the best, which are the best settings for the music, I have to always ask what's that we plan on playing and then get the bet out of that. That selection and listen to it without any processing, just straight. And go, okay. And then verify, am I listening to a WAV file? Is it a compressed file? Is it something else? So I know that it may have been already altered. And then I go have at it. And then as far as music that I use to just to get a roughing in, if you will, a lot of times I'll use Rush. Has a Tom Sawyer album is one of the better ones. It has a lot of dynamics, a lot of range. And then I have a couple of classic jazz artists that I'll use. And that varies from Dave Valentine to Stan Getz. And the reason for that is the music has a staccato type cadence. So I like to listen to how the attack release of the processor, how it manipulates. And then try and listen to the combination of all the instruments together. Because you could solo out stuff and go, oh, that sounds great. That drum sounds really good. That kick is great. Then you mix it with another instrument, and all of a sudden it's like, wow, what happened there? Oh, the harmonics start playing with each other. So, yeah, I don't think there's a simple, clear way of doing it, but if you're a pop format, you can get away with almost anything. But if you're more, if you're country, jazz, classical, or spoken word even, spoken word requires a lot of hard work. I mean, heck, I worked with, two news stations, all sports station, and we had a lot of hard times coming up with processing settings that would actually work, because everybody's voice is different, symmetrical to asymmetrical, female to male. There are folks that have a very gravelly sound that really screws things up, and then there's always the microphone. We discovered, and I've been a fan of one particular microphone in most broadcast applications, the SM7B. I mean, the 5B is the best, but you can't get them. And we discovered that when you use that microphone, almost any voice works okay. If you go with the others that have been popular, you discover a slight difference in the way the audio comes out of the microphone, gets processed and handled and everything else down the line, especially with female voices. And I know early on, when I was doing some work with audio codecs, POTS codecs and later IP codecs, we discovered certain microphones just did not work when it came to the algorithm doing the crunching. You had to use a certain type of microphone with the person and female, male, and then you were okay. So, yeah, there's dozens of ways to slice this thing up. I think it's Tim's point. You have to understand, listen carefully, and, what exactly does this sound like and how should it sound when I try to push it through a pipe of something? And, that's what you do. You got to listen carefully. I like listening with my eyes closed a lot, and, I get made fun of, but what the hell? And there is a difference. Matter of fact, before the craziness we're going through right now, we were recording some live sessions almost every week, and the recording engineer and I would laugh. We'd go, okay, who's got their eyes closed first? Okay, let's go. And we have our hands on the mixer. So we don't look at the waveform. We listen to the mix, and it was fun because when we play it back later, like, damn, that sounded better than the other way we've been doing it. So just to prove a point that visually you get distracted. You're in a visual world we are. It's multimedia, and people take for granted that the visual distracts your brain. And I can tell you I've done lots of tests with folks to prove that point, and it's been fun. So there is something to be said for that. And I think in the audio recording world, there's a lot. I mean, even the forensic stuff, I'm sure, you close your eyes listening to some of that forensic audio files you get, and you go, whoa, wait a minute. I just listened to this tape, this piece three times. I didn't notice that one little thing now. Because your eyes aren't distracting your brain.
Yeah.
Yep. You can actually, another thing is too, sorry, interject. Another thing is while I'm working often with mixing and stuff like that, I'll just hit a button and minimize my digital audio workstation. So my screen goes to the one that you see back there, just blank. So I'm not looking at anything specific whatsoever. I'm just listening. I'm not distracted by flashing lights or anything. And I know a lot of us mix engineers will do that. We'll minimize the screen and go to a blank.
Interesting. I like that idea. Interesting. Hey, we're talking to Tim Dolbert, timdolbert.com, Eclectic Studios in Nashville, Tennessee. Does all kinds of mixing work. There's a number of topics that Tim does that he's expert on that we haven't gotten to talk about yet, but we're actually getting close to the end of the show. However, and Tim, I don't think I warned you about this, but I so often forget this. It's going to be time for the tip of the week in 2 minutes. So, Tim, you got two minutes to come up with a tip of the week. And yes, your tip could be read my article that I wrote on the website. But maybe you've got a tip for broadcast engineers. Tim Dolbert is our guest. Chris Tobin's along. I'm Kirk Harnack, and our show is brought to you in part by my friends at Angry Audio. Yeah, don't get mad, get angry. AngryAudio.com is the website. And I got something to show Tim here. Tim, have you ever been in the studio doing your mixing thing? Maybe you're wearing headphones someday, and the problem is when your headphone jack is plugged in somewhere around your tabletop, and doggone it, you turn just wrong and you rip your pantyhose on the headphone jack. That's a problem for some of my radio stations. So look at this sexy thing right here that Angry Audio has come up with. This is the anti-pantyhose ripper headphone jack. It actually keep you from, you know, getting your jeans caught on that, or just your skin, because it's nice and smooth around here. This kit can mount several ways, but the typical way is you mount this up under your audio cons, your tabletop, plug your headphones in here. And by the way, it's got both kinds of headphone plugs. As we say, it's got country and Western. Yeah, both kinds here, eighth inch and quarter inch headphone plugs, and a great volume control. It'll blast your ears out. I don't think it's compliant with any particular laws about volume. So, it'll give you all the volume that you need for you hard of hearing DJs. And on the back, look, it's got a couple of, RJ45 jacks. Now, these are not for Ethernet. This is the studio hub standard for wiring. So you get, left and right balanced audio going into this. You can, power it either externally from this little jack right here. It's 16 volts AC, and you can inject that power onto the RJ6 cable, RJ5-6, I'm sorry, the Cat5, Cat6 cable, and go on to more headphone jacks. So if you've got a studio, a talk studio with several positions around, you need to give everybody their own volume control. They get their own volume control, but they all get the same audio, just with Cat5 cabling. That makes it really easy. And the power is carried from one to the next to the next with that same Cat5 or Cat6 cable. So check that out. That's the headphone gizmo from angryaudio.com. They also make this one, too. This is really cool. This is for tabletop mounting. And look, it's square here and it has a much bigger plate on the top. That means you drill a round hole, take a round 2 3/4 inch hole saw, drill it in the top of your desk, plop this right down in there. It fits just fine. Screw it down, and it looks like you worked all day to make a square hole. It's absolutely beautiful. It does have its own headphone volume control, but it's also got logic on it for a cough switch, or it can be on-off logic, depending on what kind of console you have, but there's logic in the back there. This is called the Guest Gizmo. It's for your guest, so they can have their own volume control and cough switch. Check it out from angryaudio.com. And as always, I want to remind you that you get a free Studio Hub certified patch cable, a 7-foot shielded patch cable, when you order a Studio Hub adapter cable. That's the ones with the female RJ45. And here, I'll show you the, if you order ones with the XLRs on one end, right, and RJ45 on the other, that's the Studio Hub standard for quick and easy balanced audio wiring. Just tell your dealer, hey, I want that free cable that Kirk told me I could get. And you get one of these free with every adapter cable that you buy. Thanks a lot to Angry Audio for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. Chris Tobin, we'll hit you up first and give Tim a few more seconds. Tim, Chris, do you have a tip of the week for us?
I'm just going to review, go back to our, since we're in, so to speak, lockdowns, open up, we're not sure what we're doing. And I know from working here in the city, getting around town's a little difficult at times, getting in and out of buildings. So if you're an engineering person, whether you're a full-time on staff or you're a freelancer running around from site to site, you might want to consider lanyards and putting all your stuff on one place where you can grab it and know that you have it, since getting around is a little harder than usual. This gets me into about four different locations here in New York City, and all I have to do is when I get the phone call in the morning or in the evening, I grab this and go, and I'm in good shape. Thankfully, I can do it.
That would have saved my bacon last weekend. I drove 6.5 hours to Cleveland, Mississippi, and forgot my keys. I drove I drove one vehicle. They were in the other vehicle. And now, most of our sites have lockboxes on the outside, but the station apartment doesn't. So I had to make some special arrangements to get into the station apartment to lay my head down that night.
Right, right. But you have to bear in mind now, with given the conditions we're operating under, security at some sites now has changed. So, yes, yeah, I have lockboxes at several sites I go to, so I don't have to carry it more than that already. But now getting into the site, which was a normal, real easy card key, we're done, now requires card key plus other stuff. And it can be annoying if you have the wrong card key.
I guess so. Hey, some of those card keys, if you got a card key for one place, you might be able to ask the security people at another place, can you just recognize my card key? And so I've got a card key. Believe it or not, I've got a card key that opens up Channel 4 here in Nashville and the Telos Alliance in Cleveland, Ohio.
That's luck. That they're supposed, the database, the IDs are supposed to be totally random and different. And technically not supposed to have that happen. At least that's
we'll hold it against you. We'll see what your number is, and we'll just tell our system to accept your number.
If you're lucky enough to have the same system readers, you can have will work. What's changing now is the system readers are changing. They just did that in one of the buildings I work in. My card works great in the other two buildings, but the third building, they changed the readers. Same card, same RFID technology. The reader's different. I'm like, Tim, are you thinking?
Tim, we got 2 minutes. What tip might you have for us?
I got two real quick. One, the most important piece of studio gear that you can possibly have in a recording studio besides your ears and yourself is the room design, the acoustics, the speakers, the playback like that. That is the most important thing. You can have all the most expensive preamps and microphones and everything in the world, but if you don't have a properly designed room to listen to it in, you're just going to be swimming upstream forever. And the second thing is straight out of Audio Forensics and my experience with Audio Forensic. If you feel like recording your spouse because you think they're cheating on you, don't. It's probably time to just have a conversation with them and talk to them. Besides, if you record them and you are correct, it's really tough. It's not something, it's better if you just talk to them.
Yeah.
Time to have a conversation at that point. You don't want to hear it. You don't want to hear it if it is true. And if it's not true, the level of trust that's been invaded and destroyed at that point is hard to repair.
I hear you. Whew. That's got to be tough no matter where your situation is. On the one hand, I'm glad you provide such services. On the other hand, it's tough for people who feel like they have to do that. And that's good advice. Don't even do it. Have a conversation.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Tim, thank you very much. Well, you left us on a serious note there. Your website is timdolbear.com, and we'll put you in the show notes for that if you want to look and read about what Tim does. Tim, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Anytime. I'd love to come back and talk about any number of subjects with you.
I'd love sometime to talk about the topic that is bothering or has bothered for 20 years a lot of broadcast engineers, and that is the mastering that we get on commercial recordings. We get square waves, and our processors don't want to ingest square waves.
Nothing mess up and destroy a mix faster than a bad mastering job that's just smashed. I can talk on that for a while.
Good. We'll all agree. Hey, we got to go. Big thanks to Tim Dolbear. I'll have his website up on the show notes. Thanks to Chris Tobin for joining us, especially from a broadcast facility way above Manhattan. Thanks so much to Suncast, our producer, for producing the show this week in Radio Tech, and also to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, home of lots of fine podcasts. Hey, Chris, I guess we'll see you real quick if we can say goodbye to you. Thanks a lot for being here, Chris.
Okay. Yeah, no problem. Thanks, Tim.
I appreciate it. Appreciate it. And thanks to our sponsors. Be sure you check them out. Broadcast General Store, BGS.cc, MaxConnect, Wireless.com, and AngryAudio.com. Links to those are in the show notes. Also, Nautel, sign up for that webinar next Tuesday. They've been a lot of fun, and we learn a lot, too, from real engineers who are in the field doing these things at nautel.com/webinars. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.